Good morning and welcome to the third installment of the Indian States Engagement Forum. Interestingly enough, our event is actually falling closely on the heels of US Infrastructure Week, which was here last week. Of course, that was focused primarily on infrastructure development here in the United States, which we know is ailing and requires some investment as well. But today our focus is gonna be on India and her states. So I'm Karthikey Singh. I'm the Deputy Director of the Wadhwani Chair in US-India Policy Studies here at CSIS. And it is my pleasure to welcome an excellent panel of guests we have here today to discuss infrastructure. But before we begin, I have to make a small security announcement. In the case of an emergency, I'll be your safety officer. We have a meetup point near National Geographic, and I will lead you through that process, but I don't think that we should have any emergencies. Again, thanks for coming today. This should be a really interesting discussion. So we've titled this event Building the New India. And why? Because I think if anybody has been to India as of late or has been going for the last good decade and some change, there's a whole new buzz of construction activity. And I'm talking about just the changes in the urban centers, of course, new metro lines opening up, new roads being developed, new slum improvement programs, water and sanitation works. But based on the kind of budgets being allocated by the central government and implemented by the states to the tune of $118 billion and expected to be augmented by another $112 billion, we know that every corner of the country will be impacted by the scale of infrastructure investment that India, the central government, and again implemented by the states, is expected to have an impact. So I've experienced some of this development firsthand, both through my academic fieldwork, which has taken me to some really remote corners of the country on the energy access side of things. More recently, since I've joined CSIS, we have had a really interesting time in engaging with state energy officials. And in trying to get from state capital to state capital, I have a whole new appreciation for air connectivity, which I know that the central government has a new scheme to improve air connectivity throughout the country. So there are some challenges. And now the slew of central government schemes that have been unleashed will sort of leave you breathless. I think we can all agree to that. So there's about 50,000 kilometers of road networks, $120 billion of investment to modernize existing ports, and develop new ones. One other flagship scheme is the 100 Smart Cities initiative. So 100 cities that will be rejuvenated or augmented, or new city centers that will be created that will have all sorts of new smart infrastructure outlay. Development of new inland waterways, dedicated rail freight corridors to unlock the economic potential between different centers of growth in India. Development of new metro rail systems and airports, and of course, all the investments going into the power infrastructure. But of course, for all of these projects to succeed, the central government will need the cooperation of India's states. And that's what we're really trying to unpack here. So the Wadhwani Chair has been working to uncover policies and reforms at the state level. What we want the public to know, and the one thing that you should really take away from the conversation today, is that India is more than just India, one nation state. It is a collection of 29 powerful dynamic states. In order to engage with India, you must engage with her states. And what we have here on the panel today is a range of really strong partners for India to assist India and her states on the development of infrastructure in the country, and they all have their unique approaches. So today I want to start out with Anne-Marie Yastashak, who is Deputy Assistant Administrator for Asia at USAID, to lead us in this discussion. Anne-Marie is a lawyer by training and a senior member of the Foreign Service, who has a long and distinguished career serving the US government from Burma through Central Asia right up to Eastern Europe. I know that was a small snapshot of all the work that you've done, and I apologize to the panelists in advance. All very distinguished, honored to host you in this discussion. So before I give her the floor, I just have to say that having served in the US government myself at the Department of Energy and collaborating with USAID, I know that their footprint in India is quite large. And more recently, as part of our State Department-funded initiative called the U.S. India State and Urban Initiative, I, along with some of my colleagues, have traveled to about 17 Indian states, and in a number of these state meetings with senior bureaucrats in the energy and transport sector, I was told USAID was just here, and I almost felt like I was tracking USAID as they had just done a round of meetings or something, but the footprint is quite broad. So I'll just hand the floor to you to make your opening remarks.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here today and to talk about India and what USAID has been doing in India. We've had a footprint in India for more than 70 years, and in that time we've partnered with the government of India as well as a number of the states and some of the most pressing development challenges, including acute food insecurity, inadequate infrastructure, and strengthening the capacity of the governments to really be able to manage and implement its own development agenda. USAID historically, our infrastructure-related accomplishments in India are significant. We've helped to establish the first Indian Institute of Technology, 14 regional energy engineering colleges, 8 agricultural universities, and 20 thermal and hydroelectric power plants with over 1,000 irrigation systems. That's huge. That's really one of our, I think, our shining lights in the things that we've been doing. We've also helped to launch the first municipal bond for water supply and sanitation infrastructure development in India. So that gives you kind of the breadth of what we've been doing over the years. In India, as the country has changed, so has our development programs. And we're consistently evolving our partnership with India, and it really reflects the country's development progress. So what really started out as a donor-recipient relationship, we've really turned into now a strategic peer-to-peer partnership on development. And we're continuing to evolve that relationship as we go forward. Today, India has a significant domestic resources, strong institutional capacity, and a development-focused government. And so these factors present opportunities for us, again, to change the way we do business and evolve further in India and really, really capitalize on the partnerships that we've had with the Indian government. But as significant as the development gains have been in India, there's still a significant amount of work that needs to be done. And sometimes we even call this two Indias, a burgeoning middle to upper class and a large proportion of the population who have not reaped the benefits of the country's growth. Our continued partnership with the government and the people of India aims to generate a broad-based shared development, including at the state level, and infrastructure improvements are critical to achieving the inclusive development that we've been talking about. I'd like to take a minute just to kind of clarify some of USAID's approach to infrastructure, whether it's in India or any place else in the world. We generally do not invest in the direct construction of large infrastructure projects, such as dams, pipelines, or ports. Instead, our partnership with the country is really to improve the regulatory and enabling environment to attract fair, sustainable infrastructure investments that do not lock them into a debt trap. We are looking at addressing a number of the binding constraints that has shied away investment, such as the weak regulatory environments, constrained fiscal space, high rates of corruption, weak rule of law and contract enforcement, ineffective procurement processes, and human capacity, and really transparency, and really obtaining to international standards. We're prioritizing our partner countries to mobilize their own domestic resources to more effectively engage with the private sector and other international actors to unlock new streams of infrastructure financing, which is really important for self-sufficiency and what we've been calling our journey to self-reliance. USAID also works on the environmental and social safeguard reviews that we've been looking at as well. But ultimately, our goal is to help the partner countries become self-reliant so then they can lead and finance their own development, including mobilizing the resources from domestic or international resources. And I keep repeating that because it's really important that the countries are in the lead of their own development. I think a number of, if you've heard our administrator speak, he's always talked about the guiding principle of the goal of foreign aid is really to end the need for its existence. And that's what we're really trying to do. And I think India is a really good example of how we've changed our partnership and not really engaged in so much a donor recipient, but really a strategic partnership on development challenges. And that's where we really capitalize on gaining or really focusing on gaining or increasing the local ownership and engaging with private enterprise and mobilizing the resources. Now that I've described our approach to infrastructure development, I'd like to provide a few examples of how we've done and how we've impacted our work in India. First, USAID has convened a partnership of 7 microfinance institutions, or MFIs, to launch the Microfinance Support Program, which is to help rural families across 9 Indian states purchase reliable clean energy lighting solutions. In the last 2 years, the program facilitated loans worth about $21 million, which brought light to the home and businesses of 1.8 million people. The program has proven profitable, and the partner MFIs are now independently expanding the program to new areas. I think what's really important with our relationship with India is that we're able to actually catalyze or really start a program. The Indian government, or through the states, or through the national government, have been able to actually scale up. I think that's important, and take ownership of it, and this is one example of it. A second example is we've partnered with the private sector and the government to establish water ATMs in Hyderabad that provide safe, affordable drinking water to about 150,000 people living in the city's urban slums. In a country where many people continue to face challenges to accessing affordable clean water, these water ATMs really save lives and provide clean, potable water. A third example is where we've really have focused on Mr. Modi's ending open defecation in India initiative that causes the death of more than 500 children every day. Through our support and in partnership with the government of India, we've had a national sanitation program which contributed to 141 Indian cities declared as open defecation free in 2017, and the expansion of the toilet access to 150 million people. Our work in the near future in support of this campaign will help states improve sewer infrastructure, planning and prioritization, procurement processes, and project management. And I would also say is that, you know, visiting a number of the slums in the Delhi area, it's really been an ownership of the inhabitants and the pride that they've seen in the cases of diarrhea in children under 5 have decreased dramatically. By at least 60%, 70% in some areas. Lastly, USAID supports the Government of India's Power for All initiative, which aims to provide 24/7 power to all Indian households by 2020. To help achieve this objective, USAID strengthens energy-related policy and regulatory institutions, expands businesses and entrepreneurs' access to finance, and enhances the country's institutional and human capacity. We've supported the installation of 450 megawatt of renewables, saved 87 megawatts, and leveraged $600 million in the last 5 years. This has also supported energy access to 1.7 million people through our programs. We also have been working on a regional basis with a number of infrastructure issues, and particularly with Nepal, with Bangladesh, the Maldives, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka, to really harmonize the policy and the legal and regulatory frameworks across the region and really advances interconnectivity of the energy transmission systems, but also really provides a system for connectivity in general for the nations of the South Asia and beyond to really to be connected to one another. I'd also want to note that in February, the State Department led the U.S. government interagency to host the USAID U.S.-Japan-India Trilateral Infrastructure Working Group that was here in Washington to promote collaboration for transport and accountable infrastructure development in the Indo-Pacific region. The infrastructure working group focuses on four areas. They developed a shared definition of best value and quality infrastructure, coordinating on regional infrastructure projects, again, with that connectivity in mind, improving policy frameworks, and expanding opportunities to partner with the private sector. I'd just like to say in conclusion that, you know, India faces unprecedented pressure to provide its fast-growing and quickly urbanizing population with access to clean energy, clean water, food, quality education, and health care. Safe, reliable, and advanced infrastructure lies at the intersection of all of these development challenges. It's made significant progress on its journey to self-reliance, and USAID is proud to elevate our partnership with the people and the government of India. So I will stop there and say thank you again for inviting us to participate.
Thank you. Thank you for those remarks. I mean, I think with India, there's always tremendous opportunity as well, just like there's tremendous pressure and tremendous opportunity to achieve scale in some of the initiatives that partners can unleash. And I think you've highlighted some of them. I mean, to have presence in 141 cities and be able to impact issues that are critical for healthcare is quite remarkable. So next, I want to turn it over to Bart Adish, who is a representative of the North America office of the Asian Development Bank. He comes with a communications background, if I'm not mistaken, and has guided the formulation of the Asian Development Bank's communications policy, which has set a new global benchmark for information sharing and transparency for international finance institutions. And the Asian Development Bank is doing different kinds of investments into India's infrastructure than what we just heard about. And there are all these examples are quite complementary, as you'll see with speaker after speaker. And in particular, there's a commitment to invest, as Bart will lay out, both in the coastal areas of India, the coastal states, but also some of the low-income states in India. So Bart, over to you.
Okay, thank you so much. And thank you indeed to CSIS and Wadhwani Chair in U.S.-India Policy Studies for inviting ADB to speak at this forum. So India is a founding member of the Asian Development Bank and is the fourth largest shareholder out of our 67 members. The United States, by the by, is together with Japan the leading shareholder in ADB, which is based in the Philippines. India has been the largest borrower from ADB since the year 2010. Over the past three decades, tens of millions of people in India have benefited from improvements in basic infrastructure, energy, urban, irrigation, public sector management, and human development sectors brought about by ADB-supported initiatives. Last year, ADB committed some $3.6 billion in loans, grants, and technical assistance to the country, and these include commitments to projects to develop and or modernize state highways in Rajasthan, and district roads in Uttar Pradesh and Madhya Pradesh. Another example of projects committed last year include the Solar Transmission Sector Project, which will provide 3,200 megawatts of power from solar parks in Rajasthan and Gujarat. In Madhya Pradesh, ADB also committed $275 million to improve water supply systems in some 64 towns. So these and other projects are intended to address some of the key development challenges we just heard very clearly laid out, but those especially related to infrastructure needs, which is where ADB concentrates its program of assistance in the country. So although India has improved its global ranking in the Quality of Infrastructure Index from 87 to 68 in the period 2014 to 2016, infrastructure continues to be a major bottleneck to the country's growth and prosperity. So to meet accessibility and mobility requirements of the growing economy, massive investment is needed to widen roads, to pave surfaces, and improve road safety and maintain assets in the transport sector. India's rail system suffers from congestion on high-density routes, slow freight train speed, and high freight costs. Efficient connectivity of road, rail, and port systems also remains critical to contain high logistics costs and to build global competitiveness. In terms of power generation capacity, India needs to keep pace with rapid economic growth but here it's constrained by financial difficulties of power utilities. About one out of four households in India remain unelectrified, and many more suffer from intermittent power supply. The cost to address India's infrastructure deficit is about $230 billion a year. Yet there are sizable gaps in financing and institutional capacities. The fiscal space in some states, for example, is increasingly constrained. The central government has been trying to create more fiscal space by improving tax collection and expenditure distribution and by devolving more resources to the states. It is also seeking to revitalize public-private partnerships, or PPPs, by strengthening PPP institutions, promoting improved contractual modalities, pursuing a fair allocation of risks, and strengthening the monitoring of progress. Yet states with limited fiscal space need to rationalize expenditures and mobilize revenues, and at the same time, strengthen investment and cost recovery mechanisms. Urban local bodies need to increasingly tap their own revenue source and private capital. ADB recently, together with the government of India, approved a new country partnership strategy, or as we call it in our lingo, CPS. This is for the period 2018 to 2022, covering 5 years. And this aims to support the government's goal of faster, inclusive, and sustainable growth, accompanied by rapid economic transformation and job creation, as well as support for the Sustainable Development Goals. This assistance will focus on areas where ADB has comparative advantage and has three pillars. These three pillars are boosting economic competitiveness to create more and better jobs, providing inclusive access to infrastructure networks and services, and addressing climate change and increasing climate resilience. Under Pillar 1, ADB will continue its ongoing support for strategic planning studies to develop economic corridors in coastal economic zones, such as the East Coast Economic Corridor. And this will help drive India's economic transformation. And the work on these corridors relates to, for example, the Visakhapatnam-Chennai Industrial Corridor Master Planning, the Tamil Nadu Corridor Comprehensive Development Plan and Master Plan, the Odisha Comprehensive Development Plan and Master Plan, and also the West Bengal Comprehensive Development Plan. So here specifically, ADB is working with the states to develop these plans, and from those plans come project ideas that ADB or the government or the private sector in India or other multilateral players can then come in and support these projects. So Pillar 1 work also will involve support to Rajasthan in developing the Productive Clusters Development Roadmap and a study of developing transport and logistics hubs across India as a whole. In line with support to strategic plans, some of which I've just mentioned, ADB is also going to be providing financing to make Indian cities to address their sustainable needs, to develop clusters and industrial nodes, to make them competitive and well-connected and capable of providing a clean, livable environment. And this will entail building railways, expressways, ports, and logistics facilities to connect industrial nodes with national and global value chains, high voltage electrical transmission systems, and smart distribution systems. And these will support the central government's Made in India initiative, the Sagarmala port construction project, as well as the Act East and national manufacturing policies. ADB's urban investments will contribute to the government's Smart Cities initiative. ADB will also support long-term urban development planning and basic urban infrastructure investments, including for multimodal public transport facilities and smart transport management. And since the corridors will cover multiple states, ADB will explore assisting large-scale infrastructure investments through clusters of sector investments in larger areas and/or multi-sector projects in specific cities and clusters in a sequential manner. With regard to the second of three pillars, ADB is going to finance investments in infrastructure and institution building in states and areas with poor access to transport and energy. In the transport sector, ADB finance projects will focus on improved road connectivity at the state, district, and rural levels to improve access to services and to enhance productivity and incomes. Assistance for rural road development will continue. Attention will be given in the context here to capacity building, road safety, sustainable road maintenance, innovative materials and technologies, and private sector participation. Investment in railways will help local industries access freight transport services. In the energy sector, ADB is going to support the government to target uninterrupted electricity connections by connecting villages to the electricity grid. ADB assistance will also improve the financial and technical performance of distribution utilities by deploying smart grid technologies, integrating with renewable energy sources, and helping build necessary institutional capacity. And we also intend to provide technical assistance to assist national urban programs, including smart cities and cities participating in the Atal Mission for Rejuvenation and Urban Transformation in selected states, including Madhya Pradesh and Rajasthan. ADB is also going to be supporting feeder separation between agriculture and household uses to promote stable power supply for households. Project design will adopt measures to provide better electricity access for the poor while enhancing water use efficiency and productivity through a multidisciplinary approach. Finally, under Pillar 3 of our new country partnership strategy, ADB is going to be working with the government to implement its intended national determined contributions under the Paris Agreement to increase the proportion of renewable energy consumption. This assistance will cover solar photovoltaic and wind power generation. It will also focus on green corridors or high voltage transmission lines to evacuate renewable power to load centers through sovereign and non-sovereign lending modalities. We're going to help build capacity to enable electricity companies to integrate intermittent renewable energy. We'll also be supporting energy solutions such as pump storage hydropower to improve the demand-supply balance. ADB is also supporting methane capture from wastewater and solid waste management facilities, as well as the development of non-motorized and low-carbon mass transit in cities. We will also consider the possibility of financing efficiency improvement and pollution control of thermal power plants. In addressing each of these three pillars through this new five-year program, ADB proposes lending of $3 to $4 billion a year in the period through 2022. This compares with an annual average of $2.65 billion between 2012 and 2016. We're also going to explore co-financing opportunities through coordination led by the government of India, particularly where large investment opportunities are identified. In concluding, I'd just note that 85% of the program will be devoted to transport, energy, and urban infrastructure. And there will be a progressive enhancement of the annual lending to low-income states, particularly those in the lower group. So again, an emphasis on corridors, an emphasis on low-income areas of India, and an emphasis on building up basic infrastructure, which is vital to the country's competitiveness and to meeting the sustainable development goals. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mark. Quite a comprehensive plan. Thank you for walking us through all the various pillars. And I think, you know, in line with what Anne-Marie had said about an Indian administration at the center that is more forward-leaning and more aggressive in some of these infrastructure projects, I think the development finance institutions that are trying to match that ambition with what they're putting forward. And I think maybe that's perhaps reflective of the increased financing as well that you outlined between 2012 and 2016 and moving forward. And I think you hinted at this a little bit in there, and perhaps this will come out in the Q&As, you know, as states take on more and more debt, which is already an issue here, how all of this infrastructure planning will impact that, or how is it limiting the proposed plans for infrastructure planning and development in these states. But we'll come back to that. I now want to turn the floor over to Ryosuke Nakata, Chief Representative of the U.S. Office from Japan International Cooperation Agency, or JICA. He's an economist by training, and he's not only taught macroeconomic courses at universities, but his work at JICA focuses on macroeconomic analyses and concessional loan operations of partner countries. One thing to note about JICA is that it has emerged as one of the leading bilateral donor agencies in India, silently financing, and that's key, I guess, silently financing many big ticket infrastructure items. And they have a special strategy on enhancing connectivity across India's states. In addition to technology transfer, I think they emphasize transferring of knowledge and skills to the Indian workforce, which as the central government and the states try to address the issue of jobs, having the skill sets necessary to build the new India, to power the new India, are critical. So with that, I'll hand the floor over to Roske.
Right, thank you very much. JICA is a secret agency, so I'm not secretly financing. We are very much advocating what they do. And probably, you may have heard about the JICA, name of JICA, but probably most of you may not exactly know what JICA is doing. So let me start from what JICA is doing, because the bilateral aid agencies have very much different, the business model. And our business model is not quite similar to USAID. I should say our business model is quite similar to ADB or World Bank. So let me start from what JICA actually does. And JICA has, in terms of quantity, in terms of volume of financial flow, the majority of JICA assistance is in the form of concessional finance, concessional loan financing, like ADB World Bank. But of course, we have the grant financing facility. We have a sizable amount of technical assistance facilities. So basically, what we do is whenever we extend our loan financing for infrastructure, we would like to combine our technical assistance budget so that especially in the low income countries, the biggest bottleneck for infrastructure development is they lack the capacity of project preparation. The good project preparation is a starting point for any good infrastructure development. So we use our technical assistance capacity to help our respective country to prepare the good project. And sometimes that project preparation starts from not single particular project, but going back more the bigger master plan type project. For example, when we finance, for example, a large corridor type project, then first we have to start from whether that what kind of technology is most suitable in economically or environmentally. Whether this high speed railway is good, lower speed, large capacity, freight better, and we have to do the careful calculation of economic viability as you suggested. So, or in the case of urban development project, even though, for example, our main interest is in the metro construction, but just construction of one single metro project is not good enough for the urban sector to function efficiently. So that metro project should be supplemented by other the traffic management of surface road, or the improvement to traffic control management system. So combining those different segment of whole urban sector must be carefully planned, and with that holistic approach, the urban sector must be improved. So we do that kind of the early stage project preparation as a very much core of our activity. And once after that, we find that a particular project is suitable economically, financially, and environmentally, then we go on to the actual financing stage. So turning to India, actually India, just the same as ADB, India is currently the largest partner for JICA. In the past, until maybe 1990s, Indonesia was the largest recipient. After that, China was the largest recipient. Probably you may be surprised that Japan and China had that tight relationship, but actually we had very good relationship with China until early 2000. And now our focus shift to South Asia region. And as the largest economy in South Asia, India is now the largest recipient of our assistance. And around the same tune of the ADB, our annual size of commitment is around the 3.3 or 3.5 billion US dollars. And the majority of that assistance goes to infrastructure, roads and powers and those things. And even among that infrastructure sector, around 60% of annual of total commitment goes to the transport sector, and followed by water and sewerage, and power, and agriculture, those kind of sectors. Then why we put that emphasis on India? First of all, we have very strong political tie between two heads of state, Prime Minister Modi and Prime Minister Abe. They have a special about the global partnership program, and each year one Prime Minister visit, for example, when in 1 year Prime Minister Abe visited India, the next year perhaps Modi visited Japan, and with that repeated kind of bilateral top dialogue, we are the Japanese government, Indian government are trying to formulate some long-term partnership strategy, and I think 2014, the two governments, or after the the discussion between two heads of state, the Japan has committed around $7 billion of the financial flow, including both public and private sectors, trade and investment, and about half of that commitment is under the JICA's activity. And not just from this political aspect, from the development point of view too, the India, or maybe I should say the South Asia regions, is a success of the South Asia region is indispensable for accessing SDGs. MDGs was basically regarded as a success, especially in terms of poverty reduction. But the majority of the poverty reduction was because of the developing China, or maybe Vietnam, or those East Asian countries. And still, South Asia region, especially, for example, India, their poverty rate is more than 20%. There are more than 250 million of people living under poverty. So looking at an SDG period by the year 2030, the economic success in South Asia region, especially India, is indispensable for the success in SDGs. And so from that point of view too, we put that strong emphasis on our cooperation with India. Then how we are trying to help India, we feel that basically not exactly replicating, but a similar type of economic growth strategy that we saw in East or Southeast Asian regions could be replicable. Mm. That is by improving the connectivity of those in Southeast region like Indonesia, Vietnam, or China, and help those countries to be integrated in a global economic system of trade and investment. And with that, those countries can generate help develop the modern industrial sector, which generates a sufficient amount of employment opportunities with a decent pay. And from that employment, those countries can generate sufficient, thick group of middle class, and that will, help the poverty reduction in these countries. So that is a basic the model that we feel appropriate in global development, and that can be replicated in South Asia region too. Of course, the global economic system changing, so the same kind of the industry development starting from the textile, those kind of low scale light industry to whether that is applicable for the next 2 decades or not. Maybe it's questionable because of that automation of your protection system. And especially India is much better in like a service sector, like IT sectors. So I'm not saying that exactly same kind of business model can be replicated in India, but the same kind of help for helping those countries to be integrated into a global economic system through trade and investment, that must be a core of our assistance strategy. So our strategy is quite similar to actually ADB. The first pillar of our assistance strategy is improving connectivity. And connectivity with those countries outside too, but since India is a large country, connectivity inside India is another very important part of the strategy. And as you mentioned, that industrial corridor, like Delhi-Mumbai industrial corridor, and JICA is financing the dedicated freight railway connecting Delhi and Mumbai. That is kind of one big example, a good example of connectivity inside the India. We do the same kind, the Indus corridor, freight railway system for connecting China and Bangalore, and some other. And this next thing that we are anticipating is not freight the rail system, but the passenger rail system, the high-speed railway passenger rail system connecting Mumbai and Ahmedabad. Those are kind of very large-scale the regional railway transport corridor. Other kind of one the hallmark the project that we are financing under the connectivities. And the second pillar of our assistance strategy is improvement of industry competitiveness. Mm. And for the modern industry to develop those urban sector where those modern industries are situated should be able to function efficiently to serve those people living in the area or those industry situation in an urban area. So definitely the power stable power power supply capacity is the core. But of course within the urban sector, transport sector, we are assisting various metro railway system like Kolkata, Delhi, Mumbai, Chennai, many areas. So those kind of urban infrastructure is one important part of industrial competitiveness. But alongside with infrastructure development too, we are assisting the kind of business environment improvement the program of those country those states. That started from I think state of Tamil Nadu, and this is basically. Some kind of program, like a development policy program type, assistance. But and we sit together alongside, the Japanese, the private sectors and the state government, and agreed upon some set of, policy actions that we would like them to complete for the next 1 year. So, and once these policy actions are confirmed to be completed, then we release our funding, a bunch of funding to the Tamil government, and that can be used for their own investment of urban infrastructure. So that can be utilizing our kind of policy dialogue and our the technical assistance program and our financial assistance, and to help the state government improve the business environment. And also, infrastructure. That is another kind of set of program that we are assisting under the industry competitiveness. And lastly, the third pillar is the improvement in rural areas. And definitely, the economic growth as a macro sense, the industry sector, especially. Mostly situated in the urban sector should lead the country, but just giving that in, the growth in urban sector and the rural sector is left behind, that makes the inequality widen, and that makes probably social discontent of among those the people will increase, and that may destabilize the political process. That should be a very big impediment for a sustainable long-term economic development of the country. So in this rural area, we are financing the rural water storage project or rural irrigation project, or supporting those agriculture sector to be participate in some kind of the business value chain, like whether for example, like assisting those agriculture farmer group to be able to supply their products to a local hotel chain. Usually, the local hotel chain is the buyer of those agriculture products at a higher at a price. So, assisting those kind of value chain for the the farmers the organization. We feel it's a good way for assisting the improvement of living standard of rural area. Those three pillars are what we are doing under the three pillars. And of course, As I said, although our kind of the loan agreement, grant agreement, these are signed with central government, the majority of the project actually implementing agency is a state government. And there are many kind of troubles for us to actually implement, you know, even for that Delhi Mumbai Industrial Corridor. We thought that construction should have started a few years ago, but actually it is delayed, and only for this year we actually started for actual construction stages. And that, you know, agreements rest in, for example, capacity of state government, or maybe capacity in coordination, communication between state governments and the central government. There are many kind of obstacles for us to, you know, to overcome to smoothly implementing project, but maybe you can discuss later.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you so much. You know, one of the things that CSIS hosted last year was actually the former Secretary of State made his first public remarks before going to India here at CSIS, and that's where he talked about the shifting U.S. strategy and mentioned the term Indo-Pacific as the guiding force for our engagement with India and the broader region. And I think it's really interesting to compare, and I think Anne-Marie mentioned it as well in the trilateral recently, how valuable a role Japan plays in India's infrastructure development. And then I'm really glad, Arosuke, that you mentioned you know, the ways in which JICA engages, you know, how all of your mega sort of infrastructure investments, some of which are better known and are not so silent, like the high-speed rail from Ahmedabad to Mumbai, require the cooperation of state governments, and how you go about doing that, and the industrial competitiveness of Indian states, which I think even this Indian central government is trying to you know, make more robust. And we here at the Wadhwani Chair have been tracking that, the central government reforms, but also what's happening at the state level, which states are leading or lagging. And when it comes to infrastructure projects, land, which becomes such a critical need for their execution, is controlled by the state. And so it's good to, it's not surprising to hear that you know, some of those factors played out in the delays in the construction. Now let me turn it over to Brian O'Hanlon, Managing Director of Business Development of the Global Energy Group at the U.S. Overseas Private Investment Corporation, or OPIC. Brian is a renewable energy specialist and has served in the U.S. Department of Commerce prior to OPIC, where he led the development of the U.S. government Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency Export Initiative. And I think it's important to note that OPIC's footprint in India, India's infrastructure development spans, you know, water infrastructure in the state of Punjab. I know that may not be in your portfolio, but I wanted to mention that for the audience here and those that are watching. And financing companies in the energy infrastructure sector in particular, who operate in states, you know, from Bihar and Uttar Pradesh in the north down to Karnataka in the south. And their strategy is different in that there's a lot of examining the business models of the private sector players who are interested in engaging, you know, at the very grassroots level in some cases, but in some cases mega projects that affect the last mile connectivity issues, particularly in the power structure, power sector. So with that, Brian, I'm going to hand the floor over to you.
All right, thank you so much, and it's a pleasure to be here today, and thank you all for staying towards the end of the panel to hear the last speaker of the day. So quickly, just to summarize, OPIC is the U.S. government's development finance bank. We have some limited resources compared to the other speakers that you have here. We don't provide grants, we don't provide public assistance, we provide political risk insurance, and we provide financing, and it's non-concessional financing, which means that we have to charge market rates and we have to receive a return on our investment. So we're really stepping in where we see gaps in the marketplace. I want to start by talking about my first encountering. I am going to talk about the power sector. My first encounter with India and the renewable energy work, which while OPIC will finance all manner of power projects, really in India, the name of the game is, and it has been for quite a long time, renewable energy. In 2007, I was part of a delegation talking about how India could start a solar energy program. When you come on these international delegations and when you're coming in a trade capacity, you always have to strike a balance between offering the best and brightest of what your country has to offer, at the same time not coming across as lecturing as far as what the best plans are, so that you can do all these very politically difficult, hard choices to make a country, and then you can reap the benefits of my technology and of our and unleash the potential of your market for my investors. So at the time, we're sitting there and we're trying to explain the success of the U.S. renewable energy market, where we were installing somewhere between 200 to 300 megawatts of solar a year, and we were trying to debate about whether or not which system would India benefit from most incentivizing renewable energy. Would it be a tax-based system such as the United States, or would it be a feed-in tariff system such as what Germany was championing? So, and then we would also encounter Indian banks when we would try to convince them to finance these highly risky projects such as solar energy. Fast forward now to 2007, I fly into the same airport in Bengaluru. This time, I'm not going into a terminal that only had two gates, where you were mobbed the second you walked out of that gate with people trying to grab your luggage. You were standing in an airport terminal where you would wonder, well, gosh, it would be so nice if we had anything like this in the United States. India decided after a few starts and stops not to adopt either the US method for incentivizing renewable energy, nor the feed-in tariff model that Germany championed. They, along with, I would say, Brazil, championed the reverse auction method, which led to price discovery of unprecedented, the cheapest energy prices anywhere in the world. And last year alone, remember I was boasting about 200 to 300 megawatts in the United States, a leader at the time, India installed 5.2 gigawatts of solar energy alone. That's not to even to speak to the wind or the other technologies that have been put in place here. So the growth has been astonishing. It's been impressive. Think about this as well. So 2 years after I was there in 2009, India launched under the Congress Party the National Solar Mission with an ambition to reach 10 gigawatts of solar energy by 2022. So then you have the current government come in, the opposite party that comes in, which doesn't scrap the program but adopts it and then supersizes it by 10. So now they have a goal of 100 gigawatts by 2022. And while that remains very, very ambitious and very difficult to achieve, I think it any context of when we're talking about the challenges and opportunities in India's power market needs to take that road into account. It's been an absolute impressive amount of growth. And I will say that India is the world leader when it comes to the cost it takes to build a renewable energy project. It's the lowest in the world. Developed nations, it's the lowest in the world. So I have learned a lot in my own journey in following the power sector in India, and I think that India has a great story to tell here. That's not to say that we don't have some challenges. Let me first talk about from as a foreign investor into the Indian market. It is, we have, OPIC in general in our portfolio, we have about $23 billion of commitments that we've made and financings that we've made. We have room to do billions of dollars more. I lead up our early origination efforts, so I am in India quite frequently trying to get money out the door, and it's extremely difficult to do. The financial regulations make it very, very difficult to really unlock capital. That today is not so much of an issue because you are seeing Indian banks who before wouldn't finance renewable energy at all, at any rate, now can provide financing for up to 18 years and can execute that financing very, very quickly. Mm. Whether or not that can continue, I think, is an open question when you still have the majority of the goals that the government needs to achieve in order to continue to eliminate energy poverty in the country. It's unclear whether or not the Indian banks are going to be able to carry it alone. The sector is not in the best of financial health. You also have problems that come with success. So the National Renewable Energy Lab has forecasted a study that by 2022, which is only 3.5 short years away, you could have three states, Andhra Pradesh, Karnataka, and Rajasthan, that could have over 50% of their generation to come from intermittent renewable energy sources, meaning that unlike a coal or natural gas plant, The energy isn't there 24 hours a day. You get power when the sun shines, and you get the power when the wind blows, and you get power when there's a good hydro year. So that's going to have, and it's already having some significant challenges. One of the rising threats in the power sector is an issue of curtailment, which means that even though the power is available, the energy grid just doesn't have the capacity to take it. That is a real problem because it strikes to the heart of the financial bargain, where you have these power plants are built with all with the private sector providing all the financing up front. So this is tens and in many cases hundreds of millions of dollars of financing that lenders and investors are putting up front, with the promise that over 25 years typically you're going to have power repaid on a very predictable basis. So if you do not have, if your power is not dispatched in India, you are not paid. So that strikes to the heart of the economic rationale for putting the project forward. As Ms. mentioned earlier, the state of India, like the US, is a federalized system, and power is managed at the state level, at the state distribution companies. And they are, almost without exception, in very, very poor health, financial health. And that has to do with the fact that they're not able to charge electricity customers the price that it costs to produce that electricity, and therefore they're not able to invest back into their infrastructure. So in several of the leading renewable energy states, you now have delays in payment ranging from 6 months to up to 18 months. That is simply unsustainable. You won't be able to attract the billions, with a B, dollars investment you're going to need over the next 5 years in order to reach the country's goals. You're also seeing some success, oddly, as you've seen prices come down so quickly. So between 2016 and 2017, according to Bloomberg New Energy Finance, you've had nearly a 44% drop in the tariffs bid. So you're seeing electricity prices just fall precipitously, which is good news and something that if you are official at the state DISCOM or for the few projects that are national at the national level, and you're a politician, that is exactly the type of thing you want to tout. But the danger there is that these projects take, solar plants take about a little over a year to build. Wind projects take between anywhere from 18 months to 2 years to build. And what you're having is within 2 to 3 years, you're having those state energy companies that have signed agreements for 25 years now come back to those developers and say, I'm having a little bit of buyer's remorse. We want you to renegotiate your rates downward. And that is unsustainable as well. So I think what we're seeing is India continues to be one of the top two or three leaders in the world when it comes to solar energy. I think there is a strong rationale, if you were any country in the world, to go to India to learn from their example, their experience. But you have, I think, whether or not that growth and achievement can be sustained over the next 10 years is really an open question. And lastly, I'll say one of the big questions that we're seeing right now on a kind of a real-time basis is with the implementation of the goods and service tax, where before renewable energy was exempt from the equivalent of the GST, you now are seeing anywhere from 5 to 18%, depending on how the rules are going to be established here. So on a national level, we're seeing questions about how this will be implemented. So maybe I'll stop there and look forward to the discussion.
Yeah, thanks so much, Brian. And I think you highlighted one of the key issues that's prominent in the power sector in India right now. And through our own work here at CSIS and uncovering what's happening at the state level, we've found that state after state is claiming to be power surplus. And what does that exactly mean? Of course, it means that reliability issues have been addressed in many cases, that power plants have assured fuel supply, that there's more electrons flowing through the power grid. Doesn't mean that every last house has electricity yet, but with all this surplus power and more power along the way, what kinds of challenges will states that are already under financial strain face? And where will this excess power go? Particularly when, as you rightly pointed out, the NREL report report that I think USAID might have also had a hand in examining the Greening the Grid initiative suggests, you know, on the state chapters, look at the intermittency issues that will arise in several of these states and what are the solutions that might be uncovered. And that's where I think we at CSIS think that there are some lessons to be learned from US states that have undergone that some of that transition here. So thank you all so much for your comments. I know that we have about 15 odd minutes here for question and answer. I want to start out by, I will exercise my rights as moderator to ask the first question. You know, you've laid out your strategies and the issues that are critical in getting investment into or providing technical assistance and supporting Indian states' infrastructure agenda. How much coordination is happening amongst all of these institutions? Do you find that you are having conversations, and this is a question for any of you, if there are constant conversations between these different financing institutions, and or do you look to the Indian central government to do that?
I guess I can start.
Sure.
I would say that on the U.S. government side, we're very coordinated. We talk often to our fellow agencies, particularly Department of Energy, Department of Commerce, with OPIC. Again, USAID and our soft infrastructure work is really kind of setting the stage for a lot of these engagements on the legal enabling environment to allow our sister agencies to really come in and do more of the deals. We talked about that a little bit before the session. Not having that makes it a lot harder for investment, mm-hmm. and the regulatory environment to allow for the investment. So I would say that, you know, really amongst the U.S. government here in Washington as well as at POST, we're pretty much lashed up on where our roads are and how we work together.
And between, across agencies?
Yeah, actually, you know, governments. I'm not pretty sure how much, you know, we do in the case of India, but in the most of the countries in Asia, you know, usually World Bank, ADB, and JICA are the three biggest, you know, loan providers. So in many cases, we hold so-called joint portfolio monitoring meeting that, you know, all three donor lending agencies sit together. We, you know, on the other side of the table, you know, respective government and the implementation agency, and we discuss and review how much of the progress and how much of the delays are found, and what are the major common reasons for the delay. And under the, you know, chairmanship of the central government, like a joint secretary, a deputy secretary, we discuss, you know, the major kind of impediments of the the project. Most of the cases, you know, as you said, the delay in land acquisition or delay in environmental protection approval, those are usually the biggest, you know, delay. And another thing is probably, you know, the lack of, you know, the in the agencies, you know, the respective government agencies, the share of, you know, the budget. Because of their delay in, you know, allocating sufficient budget for their part, you know, other part is kind of delay. And in case of India, I heard that, you know, sometimes even the delay in release the fund from our contract is, you know, something, you know, observed. You know, basically, you know, we do not, you know, give our money to the Indian government, but, you know, based upon the kind of agreement, Indian government should sign that, you know, okay, that this contractor has completed the certain level of, you know, the work. So based upon that progress, please, you know, JICA, please send, remit the, you know, amount for the contractor. But, you know, their signing of these, you know, work completion kind of certificate is delayed, and the contractors are just waiting without being paid. Mm-hmm. That may happen. So I'm sure, you know, the same kind of, you know, issues are kind of observed in the World Bank ADB's project too. So it is quite, you know, the common that those three agencies, you know, get together and put some pressure for, you know, the central government, state government, as well as central government, to monitor this, you know, progress and rectify those. You know, I think that happening.
I would just add one other thing is that we really have been working on trilateral cooperation with the Japanese, the U.S. government, and India, and I think that that's been very helpful in really coordinating all the work that we're doing.
Great. Excellent. Well, I'm going to open it up to the floor now for questions. So yes, I believe you have the first one.
Years ago, I used to work with Mitsubishi and NTT, and we built a company called Zygonaut. It was wearable, mobile, and I'll be talking about improving connectivity in an industrial infrastructure, and we talked about the word smart. So what are you all doing to do supply chain security as you go to this more technologically engaged connectivity? What are you doing for supply chain security?
Great. The way I'll do this is I can take a couple more questions, and then we can just pose them to the panelists here. So we'll take one more.
Hi, Kathleen Mister, Industry Advisors. I have a client who's a small solar firm, and I'd like your advice on what should his annual turnover be before he tries to enter India, and how much should his investment, how much should he be prepared for as an investment in India to build a plant?
Great. Excellent. So we'll stick with those two first. Is your question directed towards Brian? I'm going to guess that's an appropriate question. And the supply chain security question, I'll throw up to either one of you that wants to address.
What aspect of security are you talking about?
Yeah.
Cyber.
Cyber. Well, I mean, this is a consideration not unique to development projects in India. And ADB has an IT department that is constantly informing our management of the risks, because you need specialists on that. And so we have an in-house team that's looking internally on our own operations. When I get on my phone or on my computer and I'm connected to our network, they're ensuring that we're not being infected and we're not at risk, you know, we're limiting any risk of hacking, that sort of thing. And the context of developing programs with our member countries, including in this case India, this will naturally become a part of discussions, for example, of master planning. If you're looking at how corridors are linking supply chains, increasingly this is becoming a part of it. So, it's a concern for everybody.
Yeah. Great. And Brian, if I could just add to the question that's
sure.
being directed at you. So as you're evaluating some of your investments, how deeply is OPIC looking at, as you alluded to, sort of state fiscal health and the market which some of these companies are hoping to have an impact in, particularly, I guess, in the power sector?
Sure. So your small client, is that a manufacturer or a developer or an EPC company?
It's
a manufacturer, okay. It's a great question. I don't know if I'm best placed to answer this because we finance like the investment. So I'm financing, you know, a project developer that's moving in here. But putting on my slightly old and dusty Department of Commerce hat, I really think turnover is not so important. I do think that it's really going to depend on if this is a first-time exporter or if this is a company that has experience moving into other markets. I think that in the Indian market, you're going to have some boots on the ground, and so that's going to be a significant investment. And as been mentioned many times, India is not one market, it's multiple different markets, and depending on who the natural buyer is going to be, whether that's going to be an EPC firm that is going to be in charge for, you know, procuring all the equipment for a solar plant, putting it all up, depending on what your market segment is, whether it's consumer or whether it's large utility scale, it's really going to vary. But the U.S. Department of Commerce has fantastic export assistance center resources that can help on that. And I will say that in 2007, on one of the trade missions that I went on to India, we had a green around the ears Silicon Valley investor who then went on and, you know, took the money and tried to figure out how to do solar. And he now runs one of the top three solar companies in India. And then to answer the question, so OPIC for a time, our first investments in the space were in Gujarat, and we're small, and we had a few bumps along the way, and Gujarat is kind of seen as one of the gold standards. We've since then, that's worked out well, and so OPIC has, traditionally we've looked at only national NTPC or SECI, which are the kind of the national investment grade off-takers. We are now actually dipping our toes and looking at certain states, and we will look at extremely carefully, meaning that we're going to need to be able to look at the books, or we're going to have to get strong data on what the payment history is. And then there are certain ways with a structured financing, as we would do, there are certain ways you structure around it, but whether or not that's something that our developers would find attractive. We'll have to see. ADB has done a little bit more work in this space than we have, and so we would, to get to your other question, while OPIC has the ability to do very, very small deals on our own, like $5 million deals up to $350 million on our own, we often will co-finance with our friends, particularly the multilaterals and the bilaterals, because they have experience where we don't, and we complement each other.
Thanks. Yes, you over there?
Sure, thank you very much. So my question is about community engagement. So a couple of decades ago, there were massive infrastructure investments in the US, the interstate development. And until now, this continues to be a trauma for many local communities that were displaced during this development. You see the signs in the protest signs in the American History Museum, white man's road through black man's home. And how do you prevent that this same trauma is being developed right now during your projects in India?
Some issues around safeguards, I think, is what's being
I'd be happy to jump on that one.
Yeah.
The Asian Development Bank has a very stringent set of safeguard policies addressing situations where there may be a project finance where indigenous peoples are affected, where there might be resettlement in a very populous country, and where there are projects in urban areas, you may have substantial resettlement. Also in the case of in the environment, of ensuring not only on the social side, but on the environment side, that we're looking to mitigate, limit any kind of negative environmental impact. All of our infrastructure projects undergo a poverty and social analysis, and this is part of the project preparation. Recently, we've instituted a practice where every single project has to have a grievance mechanism built into the project itself. So if communities feel like, notwithstanding these efforts to mitigate any harm, and to also, beyond that, to also seek community inputs on project design, but if there are grievances that they can be dealt with at the project level, if that's not satisfactory, we have an accountability mechanism that can be accessed in whatever local language and anonymously to help solve problems. Or to have a thorough investigation if it's shown that there's the potential that because we didn't follow our policies, harm was done. So, I mean, I could talk further length, but we take this quite seriously. And frankly, you mentioned two decades past and focusing, I guess, in the U.S. I mean, our own experience has been one of learning, and it's been difficult because it's not just us as a finance institution. These projects don't belong to us. They belong, in the case of our sovereign lending, to the government of India. Right, so the borrowing is done accepting these standards and requirements, but given capacity limitations and such, it's hard to always get it right, especially when you're dealing with complex situations and lots of families. So I'm not saying we've reached nirvana, but increasingly we've put more people on dealing with our safeguards, and we have very strict standards that are held up along with the standards of the other international financial institutions as the best international standard pretty much going at the moment.
Our environment safeguard, guideline is quite similar to ADB and the World Bank. And you see, and we have kind of a panel of experts, external panel of experts, to review those project whose other environmental or social impact, negative impact is very high. Then we have to present the project. And even during project preparation stage, we have to present our kind of finding, our process. Actually, as I said, not our process, no, their process that we are monitoring should be reported to the external panels. And whenever there is any kind of a deviation from agreed kind of standard, they have right to jump in. And of course, the local residents have a right to the report for any kind of misconduct directly to JICA. We have open kind of communication channel so that they can directly report to those I forgot about the name, but guideline monitoring the responsible position. And he has a direct reporting requirement to our president, not our operation department. So there are many layers of kind of monitoring of those resettlement or environmental impact, not to be kind of hidden under the JICA's, you know, the operation the team. They have, you know, there are many layers of monitoring, which is sometimes very much cumbersome, but we feel that this is a necessary kind of system for us not to repeat many kind of sad experiences that we find, you know, experienced 30, 40 years ago, in Indonesia or India.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the only thing I think I want to add to that is, you know, India has one of the highest populations of indigenous communities on the planet, something like 100 million, and they are spread out across a range of states, and given where land issues become critical for infrastructure development, this is a matter that state governments take up and where the center needs projects approved. I think there's various different stakeholders at play here, and I think having the robust set of safeguards is critical in this process. I think we have time for one very quick, short question from you right there, please.
On the question of the cost of energy, have you seen a lot of crypto miners trying to come into India to take advantage of the cost of energy?
It's a great question. So the price that energy is being offered is different at the wholesale level, is different from the cost of energy. So I don't think India has ever been viewed as a place where you can get just large amounts of low cost energy that you want to put these large data centers right for crypto mining. So I haven't seen it yet. It hasn't been an area that I've focused on. Yeah, in China and there are some other places in Iceland in general where they have large pools where they haven't built transmission out, and so you have a lot of captive, you know, generation that can't get out there. There's some more options for it. I haven't seen it in India, but I haven't been looking, so maybe I'm missing something.
And this is a long way from India. You mentioned Iceland, and that's because of the geothermal, but also in Quebec, you've got crypto miners looking there because of the hydropower.
Great. Well, there you have it. You know, in order to build the new India, the vision is outlined by the center. Execution requires state cooperation. I think it's really important to have the opportunity to have a discussion with a variety of stakeholders who are partners to the Indian government in its infrastructure development, and to look at their strategies for state engagement. You know, I think very interesting points highlighted, you know, by the representative from JICA about how they evaluate state industrial competitiveness and enacting a number of reforms in order to allow for investment to flow forward. And of course, you know, while there are unprecedented challenges, you know, in developing India's infrastructure, there are unprecedented opportunities. So I want to thank you all for participating in today's panel, and thank you all for coming, and to those that are watching online. Please give them a hand.